Five Aspects of Woman, Lesson 12, Life Giver Redeemed. From the beginning, God created women to be life givers. However, since the curse, life giving is weighed down with sickness and death. It is embattled with sin and selfishness. Love is the heart of life giving, but only Christ can recreate loving life givers from fallen, selfish death dealers. Only He can renew us in our continual struggle against the pain and toil of the curse. Jesus is life and the source of it. We are His channels and vessels. This lesson includes three main parts. First, a survey of New Testament life-giver verses undergirds the validity of this aspect for our day. Second, a study of Christ outlines the struggles and virtues of the ultimate life giver. Finally, a biblical survey of life-giving women reveals how God redeems women and enables them to give life in this fallen world. The pastoral epistles are Paul's letters to the young first century pastors, Timothy and Titus. Paul writes in 1 Timothy 3:14, "I write so that you may know how one ought to conduct himself in the household of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and support of the truth." How should we conduct ourselves as members of God's church? How should godly women act in God's household? The modern world's myth of overpopulation and the feminist career agenda belittle and scorn the work of the life giver. But the scriptures are clear on this matter. A survey of the following verses, 1 Timothy 2:10 through 15, chapter 5, 9 through 16, and Titus 2:3 through 5, will demonstrate that God creates, expects, and commands a lifestyle and a lifetime of life-giving for all women. 1 Timothy 2:10 through 15 is an important passage on womanhood. Under Helper Completer, we considered verses 10 through 14. Now let us focus on verse 15, which, like those verses, is also contested and misunderstood. The New American Standard reads, "But women shall be preserved through the bearing of children if they continue in faith and love and sanctity with self-restraint." The New King James says, "Nevertheless, she will be saved in childbearing." The English Standard says, "Yet she will be saved through childbearing." What does this verse mean? This verse is not talking about meriting salvation through having children. In a parallel passage, two chapters later, Paul tells Timothy, "Keep a close watch on yourself and on the teaching. Persist in this, for by so doing you will save both yourself and your hearers." That's in 1 Timothy 4:16. In neither of these passages is Paul teaching that salvation will be earned by works. The salvation of which Paul is speaking in these passages is not the event of justification, but rather the process of sanctification, which we talked about in the Mistress of the Domain aspect. As is commanded in Philippians 2:12, we are to work out our salvation through obedience. That verse says, "So then, my beloved, just as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your salvation with fear and trembling." This does not mean meriting salvation in the sense of justification, but rather growing our spiritual maturity through obedience. Contrasted with the materialism and vanity of 1 Timothy 2:9 and the noisy usurpation implied in verses 11 and 12, Paul prescribes four spiritual virtues for the life-giving woman in verse 15. Continue in faith and love and sanctity with self-restraint. These virtues answer the perennial challenges of the life giver in her years of pregnancy or child rearing. Faith quiets worry. Love refutes selfishness. Sanctity answers worldly distractions. Self-restraint tames the temper, even as it rallies the listless spirit. If a woman perseveres in these virtues through the life-giving years, not only will she be saved from numerous incidental calamities, she will gain the sanctified character that is the goal of the godly woman. The first virtue Paul lists is faith. In childbirth preparedness class, my group was taught that one of the most important aids in bearing pain is to look at a focal point outside yourself. We were instructed to bring some object to the hospital that we would like to look at. For the Christian, our spiritual focus outside of ourselves should always be the Lord. The more intense the toils and trials of this life, the more intently we need to look to Christ. Particularly, we should focus on God as provider. A woman has a tremendous need for someone to provide for her while she is working to give life and nurture others. The husband is God's delegated provider. It is hoped he is doing his job. However, he may not be faithful, or he may not be present. Even if one is blessed with a good husband, we need to focus on God, who is the ultimate provider. Besides her objective need for a physical provider, a life-giving woman is beset with many worries about herself, her children, and details of care which no earthly husband can provide. So faith in God is the first and foundational virtue prescribed to sustain women through the rigors of life-giving motherhood. The second virtue is mentioned by Paul is love. Love is not only the central virtue of the life-giver aspect, it is central to the entire Christian life. Jesus, John, Paul, and the whole Bible teach that love is the basic virtue. We can think of the five aspects in pyramid form. On the first step are mistress of the domain with her responsibility and glory of man with her purity and gracious beauty. On the second step are helper with her heart for service and loyalty, and lady of wisdom with her skill, insight, and fear of the Lord. Then on the top step, on the pinnacle, is life giver with her love for others. The love of the life giver must pour out and cascade over all the other aspects, or our lives, no matter how virtuous, will be empty like the noisy cymbals Paul describes in 1 Corinthians 13. As a mother, you must have love for God, love for your children, and love for their father. As a teacher, you must have love for your students and your subject matter. You can give students knowledge and discipline, but you will never give them the love of truth if you do not love it yourself. If we nurse professionally or informally, as we all do from time to time, we should strive to love the sick, elderly, or handicapped for whom we care. We should even love the normal people whom we serve day in and day out. Paul's third prescribed virtue is sanctity. To sanctify means to set aside for a specific purpose. For example, the vessels of the tabernacle were sanctified for holy use alone. The sanctity of motherhood is rarely mentioned today because our society has greatly de-emphasized its importance. Most women do not set themselves aside for motherhood. Instead, they squeeze it in around the edges. Here Paul teaches the sanctity of motherhood. When a woman carries, nurses, or rears her children, this work is fundamental to her service to God. We know that we should not drink, smoke, or take drugs during pregnancy. That is one way we set ourselves aside. Perhaps it is even harder to set ourselves aside for our children and their needs in the home. Things we would do ordinarily for ourselves or to please others, we do not have time to do because we need to be life givers. We are set aside for this purpose. Finally, the scripture directs that all this be done with self-restraint or self-control. As life givers, we often do not feel like doing our job. We are harried, tired, or depressed. Many things we do during the long years of motherhood or of caregiving for an elderly parent, we do because the fruit of the Spirit is self-control, not because we feel the emotion of love. This kind of giving up of self is true love and fundamental to true spirituality. In closing this section, remember that the heartbeat of any family, church, or society is the love and the nurture of its life givers. 1 Timothy 2:15 is the manual for how to do this in a cursed world. It also encourages us that the path of life-giving, focused in bearing and rearing children, is the one appointed and tailor-made by God for the spiritual growth of women. Of many interpretations, the one that most adequately handles the textual data of 1 Timothy 2:15 is that women will be saved, with a focus on salvation's future rewards, through faithfulness to their appointed role, summed up in the example of motherhood. 1 Timothy 5, 9-10 is a classic passage on womanhood in the New Testament. It is God's resume for an approved widow. The modern opinion is that a strong resume would include a college degree, more than one would be even better, important jobs held, and prestigious committee service. Titles like wife and mother carry little weight and would not be highlighted. In our society, those titles are merely personal and have little significance in the, quote, real world, or so we are led to believe. But let us consider God's resume for a 60-year-old widow. This list describes what he thinks a married woman should have done by the time she is 60. 1 Timothy 5, 9-10. A widow is to be put on the list only if she is not less than 60 years old, having been the wife of one man, having a reputation for good works, and if she has brought up children, if she has shown hospitality to strangers, if she has washed the saints' feet, if she has assisted those in distress, and if she has devoted herself to every good work. This is an example of a lifestyle and a lifetime of nurturing. The woman described here has nurtured in her marriage, nurtured her children, and nurtured in the church, washing the saints' feet. She has shown hospitality to strangers, those outside the church, those in distress, the needy, and where there is crisis in the community. In short, she has devoted herself to every good work. God looks at these qualifications in a 60-year-old woman and says, "This is a resume that impresses me. This person is trained, wise, and qualified." Put on the list probably means that women who were qualified widows at 60 were enlisted by the church for ministries of helps, mercy, counseling, and so forth. In turn, they would be supported financially by the church. Younger widows are not to be put on this list because their character is not yet trained. 1 Timothy 5:11 through 15. But refuse to put younger widows on the list, for when they feel sensual desires in disregard of Christ, they want to get married, thus incurring condemnation, because they have set aside their previous pledge. At the same time, they also learn to be idle as they go around from house to house, and not merely idle, but also gossips and busybodies, talking about things not proper to mention. Therefore, I want younger widows to get married, bear children, keep house, and give the enemy no occasion for reproach, for some have already turned aside to follow Satan. End quote. These young women have been married, and their sexual responses have been aroused. Presumably, they do not have any children or just one or two. Apparently, Paul has tried employing such young widows and has found from experience that they are not mature enough for employment in the church. They are not good workers, neither do they have control of their tongues or of their sexual desires. So they change their focus from serving Christ to getting another husband. It is recommended that young widows remarry and get back into family life because that is the normal training ground for their building of basic virtue and maturity. The life of a homemaker is not the only path to maturity as a woman, but it is the classic path. Virgins are not mentioned here in 1 Timothy. In the complementary passage of 1 Corinthians 7, virgins who are decisive about remaining single are encouraged to do so. The single life is held high for Christians as an opportunity for undistracted service to the Lord, a life which avoids the troubles in the flesh that married people invariably have. Nevertheless, singles must use their freedom for serving God and others, and not as an escape from responsibility. The point of 1 Timothy 5 is that the lifestyle and the lifetime of nurturing cannot be short-circuited. The 60-year-old who ministered all of her life will have a developed character that a 25-year-old cannot have. This fits well with Titus 2:4-5, which instructs older women, quote, to encourage the younger women to love their husbands, to love their children, to be sensible, pure, workers at home, kind, being subject to their own husbands, so that the word of God will not be dishonored. Learning to be a good life giver takes a lifetime. After you learn it, you should teach younger women how to do it. 1 Timothy 5:16 states, "If any woman who is a believer has dependent widows, she must assist them, and the church must not be burdened, so that it may assist those who are widows indeed." Here women are encouraged to take care of their dependent widows. One of my best friends, after caring for her elderly parents for 20 years, was then called to care for her widowed and aged aunts for 10 more years. This is laborious. It is difficult and often stressful. Yet there is no question that it is the right thing to do. This verse makes clear that this is life-giver service pleasing to the Lord. At a seminar, I once asked those who were not mothers to speak up and talk about how they did life-giving. I was very pleased with the responses. One woman said she knew of a woman who was a professor of child development. In later years, she had a wonderful ministry visiting people dying of cancer. This is a good example of the kind of life-giving ministry that takes maturity and commitment, as do all ministries to the elderly, the needy, the handicapped, or the dying. In summary, the scriptures make clear that life-giving should be a lifestyle and a lifetime ministry. Those who walk this path of loving service will gain for themselves true maturity as women and a treasure of wisdom to pass down to the next generation as well. Christ is our greatest model for the life giver, just as he is the ultimate example of submission for the helper completer. This is not because Christ is a woman or feminine, for he is neither, but he alone of the three members of the Trinity has given life through his body. Jesus uses the expression, "the hour has come," for both his crucifixion in John 12:23-26, and for childbirth in John 16:20-22. Also, this idiom is used in John 2:4 and John 7:30. "The hour has come" is a biblical idiom for a time of judgment. The crucifixion was the ultimate judgment on human sin. The pain of childbirth is part of the judgment on original sin. Therefore, the similarities between woman's physical life-giving and Christ's spiritual life-giving are many. We will examine five curses Christ faced, which we as women face in the struggle to give life. Christ knew, probably from an early age, that in order to give life, he must meet an appointment with suffering and death. As pregnant women, we experience a shadow of the same thing. We know we have an appointment to give life that will entail suffering for us. We all struggle with dread to a greater or lesser degree. How will the delivery go? Will there be complications? Will the baby be healthy? Will I survive? I wonder how many times in the course of Christ's life, the real or imaginary shadow of a cross fell across him. He dealt with dread of the cross. He knew his hour was coming. Shame is an interesting part of Christ's curse because he had nothing of which to be ashamed. He was sinless and yet was considered a criminal, so hung naked on a cross. Without guilt, he experienced shame, being exposed, spat upon, and humiliated under the wrath of God. In a similar way, there is nothing shameful about having a baby, yet most women struggle with feelings of shame, or at least embarrassment, sometime during the process. We are naked, exposed, vulnerable, and often helpless. This is part of what is involved in giving life through our bodies. Christ experienced the great pain of crucifixion for all of us. Mothers also experience pain in giving birth. It is good to use various techniques and medicines to alleviate the pain, but the reality of the Genesis 3:16 curse has not yet been removed. There are specific parallels between the despair often experienced in childbirth and the despair Christ experienced on the cross. Many of this world's struggles follow a pattern. Struggles gradually build, become intense, resolve at a climax, and then subside. In childbirth, the first phase of labor opens the womb. Second, the body transitions to push the baby out. Third, the baby is born. The transition phase of labor right before the baby is born is a time of great hormonal upheaval. It is during this time that many women feel the most disoriented and hopeless. Christ was on the cross for 6 hours. Toward the end, he reached his greatest despair and cried out, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" The world itself became dark. Near the end, he was the most tired, no doubt, physically and spiritually, and the most despairing. Finally, he faced death and died to give life to others. Many women through history have died in childbearing, literally giving their lives in order to give life to another. Christ battled dread, shame, pain, despair, and death in order to give life. How did he face and overcome all these things? Hebrews 12:2 says that Christ, for the joy set before him, endured the cross. I know a childbirth instructor who keeps a large picture of a beautiful baby in her classroom. She tells her students, "This is our goal and focus. We are going through all the difficulties of pregnancy and childbirth with this goal in mind." Apparently, Christ did something like this. He kept in his view not merely one human baby, but the salvation of the whole world. This was the joy set before him, his great purpose. Keeping his goal in mind was part of how he accomplished his work. Christ endured the cross, Hebrews 12:2 says. Even though he had his joyful goal set before him, the cross was still terrible. It was something he had to endure. Perhaps the gospel of prosperity causes us to underemphasize the virtue of endurance. God does indeed bless us as his children, but he leads us through trials and testings as well. If Christ needed endurance, how much more do we in our life-giving ministries? Hebrews 12:2 also tells us that Christ despised the shame of the cross. As terrible as the shame of the cross was, Christ scorned it. He considered it insignificant compared to his goal, to defeat death and save lost sinners. Paul says something similar. Our troubles may seem great to us, but they are light and momentary afflictions compared with the eternal weight of glory they will produce for us, according to 2 Corinthians 4:17. We, like Christ, should consider our difficulties insignificant in light of the glory to come. Christ also gave life with resolve. When the time of the crucifixion drew near, Christ steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem, Luke 9:51. Thus he fulfilled the prophecy of Isaiah in chapter 50, verse 7, "I have set my face like flint." Like Abraham, who got up early to sacrifice Isaac, Christ did not try to dodge the cross. He aimed for it deliberately, with purpose. Yet the firmness of Christ's resolve does not mean he gave grudgingly. Christ died for us willingly. As our good shepherd, he said in John 10:18, "No one has taken it, my life, from me, but I lay it down on my own initiative." In imitation of Christ, the redeemed life-giver not only gives when the struggle is great, she gives willingly and freely. Christ died with submission based on faith in God. He prayed in the garden, "Yet not as I will, but as you will." He wanted to avoid the suffering if possible, but if the suffering was necessary, he was willing to endure it. Christ was not a masochist, and Christians are not called to suffer for suffering's sake. But if trials are necessary to serve God and give life, we must go forward as Christ did, with submission to God based on faith in God. Finally, as previously stated, love is central. Jesus said, "Greater love has no one than this, that one lay down his life for his friends." Christ endured, resolved, and submitted in life-giving because he loved. Life-giver curses include dread, shame, pain, despair, and death. Christ met and overcame all of these. Motivated by love and the joy ahead, Christ resolved to face the dread of the cross, enduring the pain, scorning the shame, dying willingly in submission to God by faith. Perhaps the most powerful physical symbol of woman as life-giver is a woman with a water vessel at a well. This image is found not only in the Bible, but in the art of most of the cultures of the world. In the Bible, the most famous story of a woman at a well is John 4. Jesus talked to the Samaritan woman at the well. However, there are 7 passages about women and wells in the Old Testament, which make a fabulous prologue to the culminating scene of John 4. Why are so many women at wells in the Bible? The simplest and most straightforward answer is that they did not have running water. Getting water for the household was considered housework, and so the women and girls did it, usually by carrying jars on their shoulders or heads. A similar question for today should be, why do we see so many women in malls and grocery stores with purses and shopping bags? Beyond the actual historical fact that the women got the water for the house, there is a deeper symbolic meaning. Proverbs 5:15 through 18 says that woman is a well, a fountain, and a cistern. In context, she is said to be like water which satisfies the sexual thirst of her husband. She is to be the source of a life-giving satisfaction. He should not look to another. When I lived in Vienna, my attention was captured one day in the grocery store by the advertisement of a water bottling company. It pictured a beautiful and unclothed woman holding a jar of water on her shoulder, tilted such that the water was pouring out. In tone, the picture carried no hint of the vulgar. Everything about it spoke of purity. The woman had a beautiful Madonna-type face and a soft, rounded, and gently curving figure. In any language, she clearly proclaimed, "I am a life vessel, and this is the pure water of life. My breasts give life, my body gives life. Like this vessel, I pour forth the pure water of life." I took that advertising brochure and have kept it to this day. I love the images of women, wells, and vessels so much that I have a little art collection on this theme. So please begin to notice the theme of woman, wells, water, and water vessels in books, art, and the world around you. Water is a basic symbol of life. Wells and water pots are the real and metaphorical containers of that life. Jesus picks up on this when he talks to the Samaritan woman about the true water of life. The following survey of Old Testament women at wells reveals more principles for us as redeemed life givers. The Bible's first woman at the well scene is the dramatic story of Hagar in Genesis 16. Christ appears as the angel of the Lord to Hagar, who has run away from Sarah. He tells Hagar about Ishmael, whom she will bear, and then commands her to go back to her mistress. Hagar is astounded when she realizes that God has come to her, has seen her, knows about her pregnancy, and knows about her distress. She names this well, the well of the living one who sees me. God is the only one who really sees the inner world of woman, with all her emotions and roller coaster hormones. God sees and understands all. We need to come to this well frequently. We need to know that God sees us intimately in our life-giving struggles. Our husbands may be wonderful. Our parents may be supportive. Our friends may be understanding. But God is finally the only one who sees and truly understands our individual battles for life. Hagar is found at another well in Genesis 21:9-21. I call this well the well of renewal. By the time we read Genesis 21, Hagar has been evicted from the family of Abraham. She and Ishmael are about to die of thirst. She sits down in utter despair, not wanting to see Ishmael die. I read from Genesis 21. God heard the lad crying, and the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, "What is the matter with you, Hagar? Do not fear, for God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad and hold him by the hand, for I will make a great nation of him." Then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water, and she went and filled the skin with water and gave the lad a drink. God was with the lad, and he grew, and he lived in the wilderness and became an archer. He lived in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took a wife for him from the land of Egypt. End quote. Hagar is rescued by God's grace, but in another way, she reaps what she has sown. When she is completely spent, Ishmael, to whom she gave life and faith, gives life and faith back to her. When Hagar can no longer pray, but only despair, Ishmael still cries out, and God hears his voice. Whether Ishmael is actually praying to God or only sobbing is a matter of conjecture. The point is, God answers him, and she receives the blessing. How often have you been so tired you think you will drop, and one of your children does something so kind or so spiritual you are deeply renewed by seeing good fruit come back to you? Or God simply shows his faithfulness to your child without your aid or intervention, reassuring you that he is the final and ultimate life giver, not you. As I was preparing this lesson, I thought the main topic would be love, because love is the central motive of the life giver. But over and over, what has come to me from the material is not the motive of life giving, but the means of doing it, renewal. Belief in the importance of life-giving is often not the problem. Finding the strength to do it is. God's gift of renewal means it does not all depend upon our strength. When we are out of strength, He picks us up with gifts of power and life we did not know existed. As the psalmist says, we go from strength to strength, Psalm 84:7. God opened Hagar's eyes to see a new well. When she was out of energy, he renewed her by giving her a new well, a well she had not seen, one that she did not even know was there. In Genesis 24, Rebekah meets Abraham's servant at what I call the well of opportunity. She did not water the camels to win a prince, but that was the end result. Because Rebekah willingly did the humble task that presented itself in the course of her ordinary duties, a whole new vista of opportunity opened for her. Watering camels led to becoming the bride of a prince and a matriarch of the most important nation on earth. Truly, he or she who is faithful in a little will be faithful in much. In Genesis 29:1-12, Rachel's well is under a rock. She cannot get water from this well because the rock is so big it takes several men to lift it, usually. In this case, Jacob, inspired by Rachel's beauty and kinship, jumps up, moves the rock, and solves the problem. We can think of many rocks which block our wells of life, rocks of bitterness or fatigue or sickness. But God is the one who removes the barriers to life-giving that are too heavy for us. Sometimes he does it directly, as with Hagar. Sometimes he uses another person, as in this passage with Rachel. In Exodus 2:15-21, Zipporah's well is not under a rock. Instead, it is surrounded by thugs. Every day she and her sisters, as shepherdesses, draw water for their flocks. But every day mean men drive away the women's sheep to water their own sheep. Thus they unfairly make the women draw all the water. This is a genuine case of men oppressing women in the workplace. However, this time Moses shows up and with all the skill of an Egyptian warrior, drives off the wicked shepherds, drawing water for Zipporah and her sisters. Just as God will lift the rocks too heavy for us, he will fight the battles too fierce for us. Sometimes life's solutions come directly from God, but very often God uses godly men to perform his saving ministries. Just as women are called to be life givers, men are called to be saviors and providers, as in these cases of Jacob and Moses. Jacob went on to marry Rachel, and Moses married Zipporah. Men give life by husbanding life-giving women. As they provide, defend, and shepherd women, they fulfill their own life-giving ministry from God. John 4 records a woman's ultimate encounter with a man at a well, with a man who was not merely a man, but who was, in fact, the God-man. Jesus and this woman talk, as it seems so fitting, about life at the ultimate level. The John 4 conversation between Jesus and the woman at the well is probably the most important conversation between a man and woman in history. Equally famous as an example of evangelism, race relations, and respect for women, this passage is also the ultimate answer to woman's perennial water problem. Every woman in this world is a cursed life giver, strained, drained, and dry. The only real answer to her problem is an artesian well springing up inside. Jesus, who is life, offers this. Jesus still meets women at the well. Whether a woman's life source is lost in the desert, embattled by thugs, or covered with a rock, Jesus is the Savior of those who struggle for life. In the gift of salvation, Jesus gives the one drink that lasts forever. After that, he continually renews his redeemed life givers with rest, gentle leadership, and empowering comfort. Many times when I was deeply fatigued with small children, I was comforted by Isaiah 40:11, which describes Jesus this way. Like a shepherd, he will tend his flock. In his arm, he will gather the lambs and carry them in his bosom. He will gently lead the nursing ewes. Some translations say those with young. If you are a nurturer, God will lead you in an especially gentle way. Remember, he also says, "Come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest." Tabitha is a wonderful example of a life giver. Whether she was a wife, a mother, or a widow, we do not know. She reminds us again that all women, no matter what their family status, should be busy in a life-giving ministry. Her story is in Acts 9. I read from there. Acts 9:36-42. Now there was in Joppa a disciple named Tabitha, which translated means Dorcas. She was full of good works and acts of charity. In those days she became ill and died, and when they had washed her, they laid her in an upper room. Since Lydda was near Joppa, the disciples, hearing that Peter was there, sent two men to him, urging him, Please come to us without delay. So Peter rose and went with them. And when he arrived, they took him to the upper room. All the widows stood beside him weeping and showing tunics and other garments that Dorcas made while she was with them. But Peter put them all outside and knelt down and prayed. And turning to the body, he said, Tabitha, arise. And she opened her eyes, and when she saw Peter, she sat up. And he gave her his hand and raised her up. Then calling the saints and widows, he presented her alive. And it became known throughout all Joppa, and many believed in the Lord. We have noted that the Lord renews life-givers. This resurrection of Tabitha is certainly one of the most dramatic renewals of a life-giver in all of history. Tabitha gave life to widows through her ministry of sewing. In the form of robes and tunics, she left behind a visible testimony of her good deeds in her community. Ask yourself, if you died today, what visible evidence of your life-giving would you leave behind? What concrete testimony would you leave to God's love? Usually it is through our skills that we give life. It might be cooking, sewing, teaching, letter writing, or nursing. You will give life through your skills. Tabitha gave life and left a tangible testimony through her sewing for widows. She is a wonderful example of a life giver renewed. As we saw in Women at Wells, God sometimes uses men as his instruments for protecting and providing for women life-givers. On the other hand, God often renews us through other life-givers. That is, he uses women to give fellowship and encouragement to one another. Mary, the mother of our Lord, sought out such fellowship with her cousin Elizabeth by going to her home for 3 months. Mary and Elizabeth shared a common faith, a common family, and were experiencing supernatural pregnancies at the same time. Elizabeth was, however, a very special Titus II woman for Mary. Elizabeth was not only much older, she was 6 months further along in her pregnancy. Perhaps they had had a deep and long-lasting fellowship with each other over the years, or maybe their pregnancies drew them together for the first time. Either way, they found true fellowship and encouragement in one another as they walked similar paths. Redeemed life-givers will be renewed by the Lord, by men who protect and provide, and by other women, especially older women. Women can and should be a great source of fellowship, comfort, understanding, encouragement, and counsel for one another. Over my lifetime, I have maintained a friendship with a godly woman 30 years older than I. I have another role model who is 20 years older. She has 4 children, as I do, except hers are much older. Another close friend and co-worker is about 10 years my senior. I have 2 other friends closer to my age, one with children and one without. These women are like posts anchoring the rope of life. We hold on to the rope, anchored by guideposts along the line. These women are key channels through which the Lord renews me as a life giver. If you are a redeemed life giver and you want to be renewed, you should seek the fellowship of other women of different ages and stations who are actively seeking to serve Christ and give life. In closing, we know that death is the final defeat of life and the life giver. But Christianity offers a hope, a renewal for life givers beyond anything that this world or its religions can offer. The resurrection is not only of the spirit, but also of the body. We have just touched on this in the story of Tabitha. Now consider the theme of women at tombs. Woman, the life giver, stands defeated at the tomb. Jesus comforted women at the tomb, such as Martha, Mary, and the widow of Nain. However, Jesus offers life-giving women more than compassion for grief. He offers resurrection. After admonishing the widow of Nain not to weep, he raised her son from the dead and gave him back to her. It was to a grieving sister that Jesus said, I am the resurrection and the life. Hebrews 11:35 puts it succinctly. women received back their dead by resurrection. In honor of their role as life givers, God allowed women, last at the cross and last at the tomb, to be first in heralding the resurrection. Jesus put special emphasis upon speaking to women about life and giving them life back from death. This is God's way of honoring the fact that we have a special ministry with Him in giving life, and a special joy in the triumph of the resurrection.